Just rolling. I'd like to welcome Steve Gibbons to Triad.
Thanks a lot. It's nice to be here.
How are things?
Pretty good.
Of course, a lot of the Triad listeners are familiar with some of your music. We've been playing the first album and now the new album. And we're getting pretty good response. People enjoy the music.
That's nice to hear. It's quite surprising, really, because we never played in Chicago, and I'm really pleased that Chicago people are into it. And I'm surprised at just how many people have heard of the band and know about us. You know.
How long has the band been together?
The last couple of nights that I've spoken about it. I got both albums. So it's encouraging.
How long has the band been together?
Almost 5 years now.
And is it the same personnel that you started out with?
Yeah, except for one change. We got a new bass player. Well, Trevor's been with us about 2 years, Trevor Bird. But the lineup has stayed the same for... Well, not quite the same. The band evolved from the old Idol Race. And originally, the drummer Roger Spencer and Greg Masters, the old Idol Race guys, were in the band.
Mm-hmm.
But after about 6 months, we were first going out as the Idol Race, you see. And then it wasn't a very satisfactory situation. I didn't like doing that because we were just getting work on that name, really. At that time, it was difficult just to get work anyway. So anything that we could glean through the Idol Race name is what we were doing.
That was
just for bread and butter and just to tick over.
That was about how many years ago?
That was almost 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then the drummer, who wasn't really committed to it anyway, Roger Spencer, he went into split and went into a cabaret band. So we got a new drummer in. And Greg, the bass player, stayed with us for about another 3 or 4 months after that. And it was the kind of thing where there was Bob Wilson, the guitarist who's now with us, and Dave Carroll came in too. So at that time there was myself, Bob Wilson, Dave Carroll, and Bob Lamb, and Greg, who was the sole remaining member of the Idol Race, and that's when we changed the name to the Steve Gibbons Band.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after that, Greg left too, and I think he went to sound mix for Wizard, Roy Wood's Wizard.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very close setup anyway, that everyone knew each other, and he was a good friend of Roy Wood's, and he got offered decent bread to do it, so he just split. And then we got a guy named Bob Griffin on bass, and he stayed for about 2 years. And then we changed after that, and Trevor came in.
What were you doing before you formed the Steve Gibbons Band?
Well, before that, I was with Trevor in a band called Balls. That was from 69 to about late 71 or early 72. It was the continuation of a band which I was in, a band called The Uglies in the 60s, Trevor, while Trevor was in The Move. And The Uglies split about 69, Trevor split from The Move, and we got together to form this band, which consisted then of three members from The Uglies, Trevor and myself. And we rented a bungalow in the New Forest. And spent a lot of time just jamming and working things out. And gradually, people were either sacked or left. Denny Lane came in. He was, he'd been in Spain, I think, for a few months after his string band had broken up, or he broke them up. And then he was sort of looking for a gig, so he was managed by the same guy who was managing Balls, a guy named Tony Secunda. And so the three of us were really hanging out then, looking for a drummer. We started working with Mike Kelly, but he was committed with Spooky Tooth. They were doing their last tour. I think they were doing a European tour. And so the plan was that we would wait until he got that tour out of the way, and then he was going to come and join us. And it seemed like there was a lot of waiting around and not really getting that much music done. We were jamming well together, but I think the first gig that we ever did was for the vicar of the local church down in the New Forest. It was a place called Fordingbridge, a little village in the New Forest. And the local vicar came around one day. He heard there was a, what he called a pop group in his area. So he organised a gig, and that was the first one we did. It was pretty good, as I remember. And anyway, to cut a long story short, I wasn't very happy with the situation, the fact that we weren't really in the studios, and I was getting a lot of songs together, and I just wanted to get moving. So I decided to split, and Secundus says, well, do a solo album. So I started to do that. Meanwhile, Balls continued looking for the right lineup. And they went through a lot of people. A lot of people came in and out of the band. Alan White was in for a spell. Remy Kabaka, Jackie Lomax, I think, was in for about a week. But most of the time, Balls were going into the studio and not really getting anything done. They'd go in there and just rehearse. And Jimmy Miller was producing too. It was just a pity because there was so much potential there, and it was just really personalities not gelling at that time, you know. And that whole sort of mad situation didn't allow the music to flow properly. Meanwhile, I was doing this solo album, and that took about a year to complete, although there wasn't really that much time spent on it. It was just the sessions were spaced out over a year, and it came out in May of 71, which was about the time I went back with Balls. And the final lineup before we split up was myself, Mike Kelly, Denny, and Trevor. And it still never really gelled. We were playing about six of my songs and about six of Denny's songs and a few sort of standard rockers. Just small venues, you know, just to try and work it in gradually. But there was no way that it was going to gel, so we just split it up. And from that point onwards, I came back and to live in Birmingham, and Trevor stayed in Notting Hill for a bit longer than I did, and then I'd been back in Birmingham 6 months, and then he came back. By this time, I'd got into the band which later became the Steve Gibbons Band, and Trevor started in a very similar way, in that he got together with some local guys, just playing in a small pub. So we'd more or less gone full circle from when we split. In 69, and then we went through all that and then came back and started again from the more or less the same place. Only by this time Birmingham was pretty barren as regards live music. There were only about two places to play. One of them was called The Railway. It was a little pub. The guy that ran the place was he was well into rock music. He was a middle-aged guy, but he was beautiful. He was one of the few guys around Birmingham at that time that had any kind of foresight and could see that there were a lot of good musicians around out of work looking for a gig, and he supplied the venue. And that was really the starting place. That was the first foundation stone that the Steve Gibbons Band came from, really. And we also started another residency on a Saturday lunchtime called the Incognito. And we used to charge people to come in. I think it was, it was about 25 cents, it would have been. just to get into the place. And the first week we had about 20 people in. Second week we had about 50, and it just built up. The place only held about 400 anyway, but after about 6 months we had it full up every week. And by doing just those two residences, the railway and the incognito, we were able to build up a really strong following. And but it was still very much a local thing. We weren't sort of playing out of town that much because we hadn't got the equipment to do it. And it was more or less a word of mouth thing, really, that got us into gigs like the Marquee and Dingwalls and the London venues, which is where I first met Pete Meaden. Anyway, that's that's a kind of rough breakdown of what's been going on in the past.
Mm-hmm. When did you first get interested in rock music?
Well, as soon as rock music hit the airwaves, really.
So your first exposure was over the radio?
Yeah, through the first rock band that I ever saw, I think I was about, it was during the Skiffle thing. It started in I'm not sure just how it took off in America at that time, but in England it was certainly through the Skiffle groups.
It's the
Skiffle
time of Lonnie Donegan and people.
Yeah,
like that.
And then after that they evolved into what they called rhythm groups.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rock group terminology came later, but initially it was skiffle groups, and Lonnie Donegan was the pioneer of that whole thing. And he recorded a song when he was playing with Chris Barber. He was a banjoist with Chris Barber, and I think just on one of the sessions he just went in and did Rock Island Line just mm-hmm. straight out like that, and it became a number one in America as well as in. And that, when I heard that, it just blew me away. I thought it was that was it. That became a significant point for me. But prior to that, I'd been listening to the radio quite a lot anyway, and I'd always had an interest in music from when I was a tiny kid. You know, I used to, BBC used to play interesting stuff, as well as this sort of mundane. Mass media stuff that they were putting out, like mm-hmm. The pop shows and stuff, which was show band kind of music, you know. Joe Loss and Ted Heath, the big bands were still pretty strong at that when I was a kid on the BBC. But occasionally you'd get gems played on a program called. Family Favourites, which was my favourite programme, because it went out on a Sunday lunchtime from about 12 till 2, and it was a forces programme when the British forces were stationed around Europe, and it was a request programme, so you'd get some really unusual requests sometimes. It's probably the troops or the servicemen getting exposed to good music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I first heard people like Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, and Cab Calloway, Phil Harris. A lot of really unusual stuff, and there are isolated examples of certain songs just staying in my head, and thinking back on that, I think that was a pretty influential period for me when I was very young, you know, listening to things like that.
When did you start writing your own material?
I think that was about when the first band I joined was a band called the Dominettes. It later changed the name to the Uglies. But that was sort of about 58.
Mm-hmm.
And the drummer and myself used to get together and write. The first song I wrote was called Vision of You.
So this was about the time that you decided to make music your life.
Well, it wasn't a profound decision like that. I just kind of drifted into it in the way that most kids did, through either wanting to sing or play guitar or whatever. But and naturally, I wanted to play guitar as well, only I couldn't afford one. And so close to where I lived, there was a small junk shop which had a banjo for sale in the window, and I bought it on I think it took me about a month to pay for it. The guy wouldn't let me have it until I paid the whole amount, so I used to pay like about £1 a week or something. Uh-huh. I think it cost me about £5, a five-string G. But that was cool anyway, because Donegan played a banjo, so, and George Formby played a banjo, and I was into George Formby as well. And so the next thing then was to find a tutor. There were plenty of guitar tutors around, but not many banjo tutors. And I just happened to be passing this place that was at the other side of the city. And a guy had got a little notice in his window, banjo tutor. So I knocked his door, and this old guy is about 70, okay? And he used to play years ago for the Birmingham Banjo Band. And he invited me into his house, and they got all these amazing pictures on the wall of about 50 guys all lined up with banjos, you know, from the 1920s. And he was a real old dog, you know. He refused to teach me chords or anything. He wanted to take it right back, you know. And of course, he was cupping bread every week. It cost me 30 bob a week to, and then I'd have to get a bus and travel across to his place. And it was very laborious. I mean, all I wanted to do was just bash out a few chords. I stuck it for about 2 months, you know, doing it right from the rudiments, you know, learning the finger style and that whole bit. And I got bored with it and quit. But I wish at that time I'd stayed with it, because I'm sure I would have qualified eventually. But and so I never bothered to play an instrument until fairly recently. I've been playing guitar for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. But it just didn't seem to come that naturally to me at the time, and so I just stayed as a singer without bothering to learn to play an instrument, which was it was a bit of a drag really, because it made it difficult to write songs. To hear a melody, you'd have to just keep it in your head. As soon as I learned to play just a few chords, I realised how easy it was. To a point anyway, at least I'd got about 15 songs which I just rattled out like that, just by knowing a few chords. That was an interesting period too, when I learned to play guitar.
What would you say has affected your music on the most part within your lifetime?
Well, there have been pretty strong influences from the like I said, I think Donegan was the most was the first, but there were obviously musical influences before that, not necessarily rock influences, but certainly Presley and the early rockers, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, and all those people. But anyone really that's made a mark, like Dylan, the Beatles, the Stones, any band that's sort of done it with strength has influenced me, obviously. But I don't know. I'm just influenced by everything I hear, I suppose. Whether it's good or bad, because you can be influenced. You can also be influenced by bad music, I think, and just stay clear of it.
You've written a tune for Roger Daltrey's upcoming album.
Yeah.
Tell me how that came about.
Well, last year we did a tour with him, and he was talking then about doing another solo album, and he said, I suppose thinking about it, that he must have been impressed by my writing anyway, because to have got involved with us from the start anyway.
So he got to know you through your tour with them? You toured with the Who?
Well, we've got the same management as the Who now anyway, and came about through Pete Meaden introducing me to Townsend, and Townsend came to see us play, and the whole thing developed from there. But obviously they must have listened to what we'd got, and they're not the kind of band to get involved with people unless they believe in them, I don't think. So Roger was saying that he was going to do another album, and he said, if you got any songs that you think would be suitable, then I'd like to hear them. And I thought about it, and although I'd got quite a few songs which hadn't been recorded or anything, it was difficult to sort of think of a song that would suit Roger. And so I decided to try and do about three or four and just say, well, what do you think of those, you know? And they were all differing in style anyway, and what the content. And he chose a song called One of the Boys, which is a kind of observation of what's going on, and what's been going on in England in the last almost a year now. It's a sort of new wave punk rock thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the significant thing about that is that most of the bands that are playing that are strongly influenced by The Who, The Stones and The Beatles, but probably The Who are the main band that's got influence over those new wave bands. And it just seemed to me that if anyone was in a position to make some kind of statement on that, it would be Roger Daltrey. And so I presented the song to him in that light, really. And if you hear the song, then you'll know what I mean by it.
How does the Steve Gibbons band fit in with the new wave?
It's difficult to say, really. Because we're still looking for some kind of record success, I don't really... it's difficult for me to get a fix on just how people see the band anyway, whether they see us as a band that's been around some time and the name is pretty well known throughout Britain. And it's... I don't know, it's... I think it's probably a good thing at this point that we still haven't had success, because... record success, because I don't think that we've shown our full potential yet. The second album, for instance, is an indication of the variety that's within the band. But there's a lot more to be explored yet, a lot more strength and force that's as yet has been untapped, I think. And that's due partly to the fact that we've had a pretty heavy work schedule and haven't really had time to take a breathing space and really think, well, now how do we intensify this whole thing and make it really strong?
Mm-hmm.
We've just been sort of doing songs as I write them, and then I'll write a song and then present it to the other guys, and we kick it around a bit and sometimes reshape it through the arrangement. We never change the lyrics. Occasionally we change the melody, but what I want to get into in the future certainly is a little bit more writing together. At the moment it's still case of me writing the songs and the other guys saying, I mean, they must dig the songs anyway, otherwise they wouldn't do it. They're not those kind of guys anyway. But there's a lot more talent within the band. There's a lot of talent in the band that would allow that kind of writing, that freedom where we can just play together and a song will evolve that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most natural way for me anyway. I find that's spontaneity and that way of writing is the most satisfying for me. So that's something that I want to get into too.
There's a song on the first album that I like called Natural Thing. Do the Natural Thing.
Yeah.
What inspired you to write that? Is that some of your
artwork? Well, funnily enough, that is a song which which came together out of that situation, that kind of loose jamming situation. That's quite old now, that song. It's first got together about 3 years ago. The old bass player, Bob Griffin, was just playing a lick one day. Everyone picked up on it. And I just started jamming over the top of it. And the main thing is, do the natural, do the... And I was singing, ain't she groovy? Just anything, just to fill it out. Just to, and I'd got the tape rolling too. And I do that all the time anyway. We'll tape the jam sometime, and I just take it away and listen to it, and then maybe reshape it or whatever. But I just did a lyric over the top of that jam.
So sort of an improvised lyric.
It was improvised in the beginning, but then I took it home and thought about it and thought, how can I make this into something constructive that's got strength and means something more than just a jam, you know. And that's something that I'm conscious of too. And I see a lot of bands that they hit great grooves, probably better than we do. Well, obviously, there's a lot of bands that hit better grooves, but it ends there. Begins and ends with that sort of philosophy, and I find it much more satisfying to be able to incorporate more than just a nice groove. If you can put something on the top of that, which is, it's like an extra layer of something else, then people can latch onto that too, and they're getting the two things then. That's what natural thing is for me. It's a nice groove, but at the same time it's saying something which a lot of people can relate to.
Mm-hmm. Other songs I like on there, like Johnny Cool.
Well, I was talking to a guy the other day. He said about songwriting. And, he said, what do you try to do when you're writing a song? And I said that I've tried to leave people with an up head, or the songs, try to write bright songs with an optimistic outlook. I suppose Johnny Cool is not, doesn't come into that category, because the guy finishes up blowing his brains out. but it's a sort of heavily cliched song anyway. It's a rock and roll song through and through, the story of it and the whole character. That's another aspect of songwriting which I think is essential to rock music. In the same way as on the new album, there's a song called Mr. Jones. And throughout rock and roll history, it's been peppered with songs like that, and I think they play an important part of rock music, that there are these characters within. It's all part of the rock and roll culture to me. And the Coasters were a prime example of that. That sort of side of rock music, where there's humour. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's humour in Johnny Cool. I like to think there's humour there, in the same way. And Mr. Jones is an attempt to introduce humour into it. Although it's maybe talking about the subject matter is serious, but it doesn't need, you don't need to feel down about it. There is a lighter side to it, and it's meant to be fun.
I think definitely when you, within the song, when you mentioned that you take a sniff and the other guy takes a sniff and then the dog took a sniff, really brings it out and takes the audience with it.
Yeah, well, that's... I find it... in America, for instance, they tend to analyse everything a lot more than they do in England. And maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe it's they just like to know, you know. But... as soon as I try to explain or think too much about what why I write certain things or why the band performs in a certain way, then I can't always answer it, because it's I think it's something, if you ponder on too much, you may lose anyway. There's something that's special to every band, and just trying to delve too deep into the reasons why you do certain things can often be damaging, I think. It's just that I find it's best to just let things flow.
It's just a natural thing that...
It sounds like they've arrived.
Food.
Yeah.